together to talk about all the things we used to do. The laughs, the passions, the little Sebastians, the pets we fell into. And we're putting it all in a podcast, then we'll send it up into the sky. We're calling it Pox and Recollection. Come on, little podcast, spread your wings and fly.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Perks and Recollection. We are wrapping up season one with one of my favorite episodes, Alan Yang. Great season. Thank you for all you do. It's been so fun, and we're going out with a bang with this one.
Yeah, big episode. This is a blast. Episode 16 of season 3. This is a real one, man. And, yeah. And it's also a supersized cut on Peacock.
Yeah.
Check it out. Check out Peacock. Subscribe. Do we get a cut of that, Rob?
I'm going to call my lawyers immediately.
Yeah, I just met with Susan Roden, who runs Peacock. I should get 5 cents for saying that, for saying that it's on Peacock. But no, it's a huge episode. Huge episode.
Little Sebastian. I mean, say no more.
Yes. Shall we get right into
it?
Details. Talking.
Yeah.
All right. Episode details. The title, Little Sebastian, written by Daniel J. Gore.
Yes.
Directed by Dean Holland.
Yes.
Two heavy hitters. Two yeah. previous guests of this show.
Yep.
Two heavy hitters. They did a lot on the show, and hard to say who did more than them other than the showrunners and the actors.
That's right.
Original air date, May 19th, 2011. The blurb, Leslie and the team put together a memorial service for Lil Sebastian. Tom makes a big life decision, and Chris reacts badly to a health problem.
Mm.
I love Tom makes a big life decision. That's reminiscent of, do you remember the Mad Men blurbs that they would do? Like when you look at TV Guide, it's like, it's literally like, yes. like the least informed. Don lives a day. Like it's literally yes, like Don opens a letter. It's like, wait, what? Right. Like what happened to this? Just Matt Weiner, the showrunner, just totally not giving them anything. Just very funny.
I do wonder how those things go. If it is the showrunner, like, or is it just some drone at a company that's it's falls to them? It's like
yes,
it's so boring.
I think it depends, but like we were just discussing my new Apple show, Loop. They asked us for the episode synopses, so we wrote those. Me and Matt Hubbard are my co-creator, or he wrote most of them. Actually, shout out to Matt. I think you can leave it to someone else, but I think we got scared that they'd be bad, so we wrote our own. And I think that's probably what Matt Weiner did too, because he's probably a control freak. Probably like you know that's why that show's good. But it's you don't want to give anything away. Why would you say what happens in the episode? I mean, just to tease it, maybe.
Well, there's a whole new philosophy of people out there that think that actually giving it away, if it's titillating enough, it gets them into the tent, and that people will sacrifice story surprise for eyeballs.
I read a study. I'm not joking. This is going to kill every director showrunner out there. But I read a study that said, the more people know about a movie, the more spoilers they have, the more they enjoy it, which seems totally counterintuitive. But that's what the science says. I don't know if I agree with that.
Agree with it. Having spent the last 30 years watching television with my wife, I know there are people who are like, is he going to kill her? I'm like, well, that's what this movie's about. We're going to find that out. But we're going to find out at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? What? Why would you want to know that now?
Asking questions. That's my mom, too. My mom will just say, like, he's about to kill her. It's like, or whatever. He's just narrating the whole thing. Just the whole. It's like a, you know what it is? It's a live rewatch podcast as you're watching it.
Yes.
It's like having us narrate it while you're watching the episode. Hey, maybe that's another idea. But so that's why you always fight it in a trailer. Like mm-hmm. when you're cutting a trailer, you're always like, I don't want to give away everything. But the trailer people will usually tell you, like, you have to give away some stuff. And that's what draws people in.
Yep.
So. Little trailer. All right, let's get into the notes. The episode on Peacock that most everyone watches now is actually the producer's cut with 6 additional minutes of material that weren't part of the original version on NBC. I actually noticed that while watching. It felt like there was some stuff. I wasn't sure which stuff was new, but because I don't have a photographic memory of what we caught, but I did feel like new stuff. This episode introduces Mouse Rat's iconic song, 5,000 Candles in the Wind.
Yes.
This quickly became the unofficial album of the show, song, anthem, whatever. Mouse Rat would perform it at each year's rap party, along with Nick Offerman on saxophone.
Do you remember the bass lick to it?
Absolutely. I could play most of the songs. I'd have to figure out the key. I think it's probably in G or D, which is like all Mouse Rat songs are either in G or D. Just always a 1-4-5 progression. But I have this photo of Nick from, I believe, probably this year's rap party, either season 3 or 4, and he has a saxophone. He's sitting on a pool table and he's wearing a sleeveless shirt. He has a sleeveless shirt and a hat on, and it's delightful. But yeah, Mouse Rat would play at the end of every year. We had a rap party, and we would play all the songs from that year, and we'd always play 5,000 Candles in the Wind. Really fun.
Can you beatbox the bass line for me right now, 5,000 Candles in the Wind?
Here's the secret of the Mouse Rat bass lines. I just played the root notes and just played quarter notes. almost no fancy. Like the one song that Mark Rivers didn't write, I think it was Two Birds Holding Hands, there was a bass line. I was like, what is this? I actually will say this. 5,000 Candles in the Wind, it does do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Like there's that part. There goes
yes.
Right, and then it like it does do that.
Yeah.
I will say playing it live, didn't always do that. Not a very good bass player. So just barely getting by. So
I'm very much into isolated bass. I don't have too much time on my hands. I wouldn't say that because I'm super busy, but what I'm doing with the time on my hands could be debated by people because my new thing is isolated bass lines to pop yacht rock songs. Like I'm very much into YouTube, the isolated bass line for Dancing Queen.
Oh, really? Are they just batshit?
They're insane, dude.
Oh, really?
They're insane.
There's something really interesting about that. My version of that is, you know, I played in a punk rock band, so it's really easy. Like my real band before Mouse Rat, an actual physical band. Very simple bass lines because it's a punk rock band. but there's a band called Rancid.
Yeah,
and they have a bassist named Matt Freeman. Plays crazy bass lines. So if you listen to those isolated bass lines, it's like it's insane. And like no punk rock band does that. So I agree. It's they're difficult. Bassist never gets any love. Bassist is just like usually the chill guy. Right?
Yeah.
He's not crazy like the drummer, doesn't need attention like the lead singer, not a ham like the lead guitarist. Bassist is just kind of chill. Keanu Reeves, bassist of Dogstar. You know, that's the vibe.
But Paul McCartney.
Yeah, that's the exception, right? He's something. He's something. He just played SoFi. I saw that.
The bass on Silly Love Songs, one of my favorite bass lines.
Yeah, playing that Hofner. Playing that Hofner lefty. Yeah. All right, this episode features guest appearances from Megan Mullally as Tammy, Ben Schwartz as John Raphael, and Detlef Schrempf as himself, recurring character in the show. Producer Greg Levine is in a scene that was shot for this episode specifically for NBC.com. It's an advertisement for Entertainment 720, and he thanks Tom and John Raphael for making him millions of dollars. Is that still available, Greg? Can we watch that somewhere? Is that on NBC.com? Does NBC.com exist?
It's now peacocknbc.com/org. I think it exists on some random sites that have like Daily Motion or whatever that have clips, but I still get a nice, you know, 10 cent or 30 cent check every few months thanking me for my part.
Enjoy a stamp. Buy a stamp with that every 3 months. Free. The full-length Mouse Rat album Andy sells to Kyle is called The Awesome Album. Not to be confused with Chris Pratt's character Star-Lord's mixtape in Guardians of the Galaxy called Awesome Mix Volume 1. I guess we know what he likes. Yes. He has the same taste across genres and across works of fiction. In some scenes earlier in the episode, I found this very noticeable. Nick's mustache looks fake. These scenes were shot after he shaved it off for the fireball stunt. So we'll get to that. But take note as you watch the episode. When Andy and April are trying to write the song for Lil Sebastian, Andy sings Champion, Champion. In season 4, episode 16, Sweet 16, Andy is looking for his dog Champion and sings the same line to the same tune while calling for him. We'll get to Champion. I love
Champion.
Yeah, Champion was somewhat based on a dog that lived in my house named Fenway, who was a three-legged dog. We'll get to that, though. That's future episodes. Look forward to that. And the great Biff Yeager makes another appearance as George, checking in on the Yeager bubble, his Star Trek trading card, now going for $499 on eBay. Shout out to you, Biff Yeager, making some money for people. All right, let's get into the synopsis. Synopsis, here we go. Leslie announces little Sebastian, Pawnee's beloved celebrity mini horse, has died, and the Parks Department will hold a memorial service for him. Tom suggests they hire Entertainment 720 for the event, a production company recently started by his friend John Ralphio. John Ralphio encourages Tom to come work with him at the company, but Tom isn't sure if he wants to leave his City Hall job. Meanwhile, the extremely health-conscious Chris finds out he has tendonitis in his shoulder and takes the news so seriously that he questions his own mortality. I love that scene. Leslie and Ben continue their romance despite a no-dating policy at City Hall, but they have difficulty keeping it a secret. Ron finds out and warns them that Chris will fire them if he learns about it. Just a little bit of story background here. We talked about this being a funeral for a person. Mm. We talked about a human being dying. We talked about Mayor Gunderson dying. We talked about Councilman Dexart dying. We talked about, you know, I think it just, there was something about, there's a history of sort of funerals and death in comedies, ironically, right? There's the Chuckles the Clown episode of, yep. What was that, the Mary Tyler Moore Show? And I think Mike had sort of this memory, you know, he had not institutional memory, but just memory of these shows. There was something about that. Ultimately, we felt like tonally for this show, it was just a little too sad to have a person die. So we're like, what about Lil Sebastian? I think it was the lightning bolt in the room. It sort of struck everyone that this was the right balance and everyone could be really sad, but they would be comedically sad. So I think that's why the Red Room settled on Lil Sebastian being the person who died, not the person, the entity that died.
I would argue that it's sadder that Lil Sebastian died.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's that scene where, not to cut ahead, but Chris Traeger is crying fanatically at the service, and we rack to Anne watching him just being appalled at how much he's sobbing. But yeah, he's the one character that both Ron Swanson and Chris Traeger will just cry dramatically at their demise. So it was really, really funny. There's a question here in the notes. Were there ever any other ideas for other animals? We talked about in the previous episode, Harvest Festival, where we had all talked about Einstein, the world's smallest horse, and I still have that email chain about Einstein. I think it was probably discussed at some point. Greg, do you remember if we ever discussed it being another kind of animal? I think it was always a little horse. It was always a miniature horse, and we always enjoyed that. You couldn't call it a pony. It's like, that's not a pony. It's a miniature horse. It's very different. It's a miniature horse. So it was never, it was never a chameleon or a lizard or anything like that.
We, the idea of Lil Sebastian came from the idea that there were these small town mascots and little heroes that are animals like a Punxsutawney Phil, right? But once I think we nailed that it was a Lil Sebastian, it was kind of clear once you found the article that that's who it would be.
Yes, I remember. And let's not forget the scene where Chris has slight tendonitis in his shoulder and immediately is fears death. And immediately, I mean, that comes up later. Like we haven't gotten to the Richard Nygaard stuff, but he has some hang-ups about his physicality, which makes sense. But I wonder if Tom Brady's like this. It's like, just if he's neurotic about, you know, anyone who takes care of their body that much. At some point, this actor, Cooper Thornton, who plays Dr. Harris, I don't know if you remember acting with him. He's very funny, but he's like, you know, what's the solution for this? Get in a time machine and go back to when you're 20. But I like at this point that, you know, you're 40 something in this and you know, it's like, I don't know. You feel your mortality. Do you remember acting in this scene?
It was a great moment where you guys, the writing staff, found a whole other theme for Chris to play. And we, as you said, it led to eventually to Dr. Richard Nygaard, the sort of existential fear of mortality and death that was so, you would think at first blush, is counter to the eternal optimist, positive Chris Traeger. And now you realize that it actually is informing why he's so positive, because if he's not positive, he's in a dark, deep pit of despair. And that was a super funny, cool idea. And we made a meal out of it in ensuing episodes.
Yes, it's a razor's edge. And I thought it was like, it was organic to the character. It didn't seem unearned, but it was a way to broaden, right? It was a way to, like, you know, you play something else. You've played upbeat, positive, sunshine, pointing at people, knowing everyone's names. We get that. But this other side of Chris was also very funny because, you know, also I feel like we haven't seen you play that. We haven't seen Rob, you know, we haven't seen Rob Lowe play that much either. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, very dry. You know, I love that scene between the two of you guys. Also, a big hit of Ben Schwartz in this episode.
Yes.
Jean Ralphio, I got run over by Alexis, is very, you know, very... like happens 30 seconds into the episode, and it's like, how did he earn the money? Oh, he got hit by a car and he got a settlement. So that's the genesis of Entertainment 720 is essentially, you know, suing somebody or getting, you know, getting hit by a car. It's like a classic scammer Better Call Saul type incident. But yeah, that's it kicks off that story, and you know, it feels like a natural progression for Tom and Jean Ralphio. We talked a lot in the writer's room about characters not remaining static. You know, this was not the kind of show that it was going to reset every episode. We wanted slow but gradual and earned character progression. And one of the ideas was that Tom was kind of entrepreneurial and eventually would find the business that was right for him, and which did not involve him working at City Hall, which, you know, is difficult in the show, but this was the first of many ideas and businesses that he would run. But yeah, I also wanted to point out that when Ron, the flag's at half mast, and Ron has a talking head, and he's like, at first when I saw the flag at half mast, I was delighted. I thought another bureaucrat ate it. So he's just happy that someone died. I mean, that's a pretty harsh joke. Like, that's like setup for the joke. He's just ebullient and joyful and sort of reveling in someone being dead. And then the turn is like, then it's like, you know, that half mast is too high for little Sebastian. Show some damn respect and put it at the bottom, basically. But I was like, boy, the first half of that talking head is rough. He's reveling in a man's death.
One of my favorite bits in this episode is the custodian.
Yes.
Interrupting the moment of silence. It's such that's like, to me, that's the sweet spot of what I think is funny. That is and the music is great. Everything about it is great, but there's a whole story behind it, right?
There is. And watching it makes me laugh for a million reasons. It's funny on its own, even if you don't know any of the backstory. But to let people in on what the origin of this was, sometimes at Parks and Recreation, not often, but sometimes the writers would stay late. And when the writers stay late, just imagine this kind of like open room with a bunch of couches. That's where we all sit. There's 10 people, 12 people, whatever. And we sit there all day. We eat lunch there. We have snacks. We're just pitching ideas. We're there at 10 in the morning, whatever, throughout the whole day. And you're just sitting in that same room. And it, you know, the air gets stale. People are walking around sometimes, but you're just in that room. So imagine you're there at 10 a.m. 5 p.m. rolls around, 7 p.m. rolls around, 9 p.m. rolls around, maybe 11 p.m. rolls around. It starts getting late. People start getting punchy. There's just, you know, you've just been in that room for a while. Now imagine you're stuck on a story idea. You can't crack it. You've been there for 13, 14 hours, whatever. You're sitting around staring at the same 11 faces. You're sitting in there. And then a custodian walks into the room. You've hit a silent patch. No one's saying anything. It's awkward. Mike's not saying anything. Dan's not saying anything. Aisha's not saying anything. Harris isn't saying anything. We're just sitting there. A custodian comes in to take out the trash. It's so late. That's how we know it's late, right? Someone comes in after hours. He is listening to what it's like a speaker on his belt and blasting music. And the song he is blasting is Shania Twain's Man, I Feel Like a Woman.
It's amazing.
I'll never forget looking around the room. We didn't want to laugh at this guy because it's like, why? But I'll never forget Emily Spivey. Emily Spivey was a delightful writer, wrote for SNL, wrote Wine Country with Amy, and just couldn't contain herself. Greg Levine was there. I remember he had to leave the room. Everyone was laughing. And like, Greg had to leave the room. It was this moment that just, you know, just cut through everything and was just, we'll never forget. It was really funny. He went in everyone's office just blasting this song, taking out the trash, and eventually left. But boy, when he left, the room just erupted. And it's just this bonding moment. It's just so funny. And so we it's so triumphant. It's like 11:30 or midnight or whatever, and you're just hearing that song. Everyone knows it. Shania Twain, massive superstar, but Boy, it's so funny. I just remember people's faces and yeah. And then, you know, hopefully you figure it out. And we put it in the show. We just essentially shot it exactly like that. And I'm sure on set, Dan conveyed it exactly to Dean. And it works. It works as a thing, even if you don't know the backstory. So I'm glad you enjoyed that scene.
Late Nights really produced two really great moments from this season, this one and the calzones. That was another very yes. late punchy
oh,
the, night.
Oh, my God.
And someone pitched calzones, and an hour later,
at 11
there
PM.
Were 30 calzone jokes. And it's just late night delirious writers.
That's just that. I'll never. It's just so. It's just so silly. I mean, there's a reason. There might be a reason why, you know, on SNL, legendarily, they stay up all night one night and write stuff. You get silly. You know, you get kind of silly. Boy, there's a lot to talk about this in this episode. We're going to say, like, this is worth mentioning. At 3:20, if you pause it, you can see the Entertainment 720 business plan that Tom has written up. Entertainment 720 will do everything, and that includes meal planning, child star training, prom planning, actor and singer booking, open-air acrobatic choreography, trust fund advisement, livestock training, and counseling. I don't know who wrote this stuff, but Greg, did you write that stuff, or did props department write that? I don't know.
I think that might have been a props department thing, but it's just the ridiculousness of we'll do everything. And I think if I remember correctly, there was a version where it says we will learn how to do those things for you.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we don't yet know how to do it. Just a tiny additional joke. And then one last thing before we move on with the synopsis. Ben's butt dial to Ron. I'm sure they had fun recording that. Leslie likes to do kiss impersonations of politicians, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who likes a lot of tongue, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Just a tour de force for Nick Offerman, who just had to sit there and watch and enjoy this and react and got a lot of laughs. But yeah, this very in character. Also, classic Mike Schur, very rated G romance. Not into getting, he's not about to write a sequel to Basic Instinct. He's a man who enjoys just talking about kissing. That's it. That's it.
That's right.
All right. The rest of the synopsis. Let's go. As the city prepares for the memorial service, Leslie and Ben are caught making out by a maintenance worker named George, Biff Yeager. So they send him home with a gift certificate in exchange for his silence. What Leslie and Ben didn't realize was that George had the propane for Lil Sebastian's eternal flame, which results in later confusion behind the scenes, which they struggle to fix throughout the night. Jerry is sent to get propane for the flame, but buys lighter fluid instead. This causes a huge fireball to shoot in the air when Ron lights it, which singes off most of his facial hair. Leslie and Ben are relieved, however, when the crowd applauds in the belief that the fireball was staged. Entertainment 720 show also proves to be a hit with the crowd, which makes Tom further contemplate quitting his job.
That is a great plot. That is a great, tight comedy plot. I mean, that is just a clinic.
It's yeah, and I think I correct me if I'm wrong, Greg. This episode was not easy to break. Finales are difficult oftentimes, but that is like you're saying, it's a bit Byzantine, but it kind of works, right? It's like it's a sequence of events that is caused by the character's flaw, which is that they're cheating or not cheating, but you know, doing something they shouldn't, having an affair with a coworker, and it causes a huge comedy set piece, right? And so it's kind of like A to B to C. Causality was something that was really important. That's something that Trey Parker, Matt Stone, and I worked on South Park briefly, were like, because.
Yeah.
And so that same thing, Greg Daniels, Mike Schur, same thing. If you're ever, it's a writing tip. If you're ever thinking about writing, don't never do and then. No. Because Leslie and Ben were, you know, making out, they get caught by the maintenance worker. Because he catches them, they put him off his task. Because he doesn't do that, Jerry takes over. Because Jerry puts lighter fluid in the thing, the fireball happens. So it's just, that's right. That's why it works, right? There's a clear delineation of events, and it's funny.
Before you guys go on, Alan, you alluded to the fact that this was a hard episode to break. In fact, it was, and I spent last night preparing for this by reading the table draft. Because I remember this was a little difficult, and I didn't put in the notes. There are two significant changes, but I want to let you guys in on them when we get to the end of the plot. Once we talk through it, you tell me what you think about them.
I'm on the edge of my seat. I want to know. I was there and I don't remember. So I definitely want to know the table draft. So for those who are uninitiated, we'll do a table read. And that's generally the week before we shoot. And hopefully it goes well. And if it doesn't go perfectly, we might go in there and tinker, or there might be a dramatic overhaul. We have sometimes rewritten episodes entirely between Wednesday and the following Monday. I remember some weekends rewriting entire episodes on Saturday and Sunday. Like, hey, can you take half the draft? And, you know, Aisha will take half or whatever. And you got to do that. But so I'm curious about that. Let's talk about Tom for a second. A lot of evolution. You know, I feel like season one, there's kind of a Jim from The Office aspect. I think we talked about that when we were going through those episodes. We're just kind of looking at camera, reacting. As the character became more like Aziz, I think, and we tapped into more of what he does, we realized he's kind of like a hustler, right? He's into business. He's into entrepreneurship. So I remember distinctly at the beginning of every season when we would do the writer's retreat, we would talk about what the character might, you know, what their arc might be for the season. And one of the arcs was he goes off and does other businesses. So I think Entertainment 720 was pitched. And then in between seasons, after the season, during that writer's retreat, I definitely remember deciding where that would go. But such a silly idea. You know, I think that one of the reasons it works is because it's very comedy forward. And I'll never forget that giant white room. We'll get to that. But at the end of the end of the episode in the tag, there's a giant essentially warehouse where Entertainment 720 is.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone here was on set for this fireball, but man, I almost can't believe that's got to be a stunt person, number one. Just to let you in, whenever there's a stunt like that, there are endless meetings, right? It's like you're lighting. I almost can't believe they let us do it because I work for, I guess, Universal Studios. That's my home studio. And boy, they are very risk averse. We had a scene where a character jumps into a pool and they're like, he can't jump into a pool. I'm like, people jump into pools. Yeah. And then I was talking to Matt Hubbard. He's like, yeah, I did a pilot and the actors were not allowed to run. like it's like they can't run. I was like, they might fall. I was like, Jesus, like where have we gone in terms of liability? But yeah, shout out to Jerry DeCanio, who runs physical production at Universal. He's like, I don't think they should run. It's like, oh man. But so this scene there's a giant fireball. I guess that's a stunt person who faces the fight. If you'll notice, they're facing away from camera. That's not Nick Offerman, I would assume. And there is a giant fireball. I don't think that was even enhanced in post. I could be wrong. Maybe we'll get an update on that. But we try to do these things safely. So.
I mean, listen, people, you know, they tune in to Parks and Rec for the pyrotechnics. The stunt work is
the spectacle.
Yes,
it's basically a Marvel movie. Yeah. Yeah. Before we knew those existed, yeah. But it's you're here for the visuals. You're really here for the outstanding the camera moves, the dolly moves, the cranes, all that stuff. Yeah. I remember distinctly pitching on this too. The shades of black for the memorial ribbon. It's Jean Ralphio and Tom, and the colors of black include obsidian, onyx, midnight, lost soul, rolling blackout, sleeping panther, and void by Armani. So I remember I think we probably have a list of 100 of these, but yeah, I remember distinctly. That's a very fun thing for a writer's room. It's just okay, different ways to say the word black, and then you just pitch a million of them, and they get in the episode, and it's fun. You see who wins. It's kind of like it's a competition to see who gets their joke in. This is interesting. So there's two of Lil Sebastian's horse friends are Ladybug and Coconut. Then Coconut takes a dump on stage. This moment was unscripted, but it was funny, so they decided to keep it in instead of editing it out. When Tom comments on it in the walkie-talkie, that was based on our actual production team commenting on it on their walkie-talkies. So they like basically the horse is you'll be surprised to know the horse taking a dump was unscripted. So I think people were just reacting to it. And it is, there's something funny about being very official, you know, over the walkie-talkie. It's
there was also a moment I remember when we were shooting this scene where there was this, I don't think it lived in the cut, where there was this elaborate, very solemn, I think Amy brings the horses out on stage and it took forever for them to sort of circle around, and it was the comedy of something taking so long that it goes from like awkward to painful to when will this end to, you know, this is kind of funny to this is hilarious, but you have to commit to the time. And I don't think it actually was in the cut, but boy, it made me laugh shooting it.
Yeah, it's almost like the Simpsons rake joke, right? Sideshow Bob stepping on 1,000 rakes, but in a 21-minute episode, which is packed with, you know, a miniature horse funeral and 500 character story moves at the end, including Leslie getting tapped by people to run for office. Like, it just probably wasn't enough time for horses slowly circling. Although I'd love to see the outtakes. I'd love to see horses just gently moving around.
It was really funny.
Always a fan. Always a fan. We get a little Jean-Ralphio Donna interaction, which I always love. Jean-Ralphio saying, "I hope you brought a change of clothes because your eyes are about to piss tears." And then Donna saying, "You're nasty." Like, that is classic, more classic Jean-Ralphio. Always a joke machine.
Well, I was like, the best Jean-Ralphio one is in this one where he says, he tells Tom he needs to live his life like that cow from the video.
Yes. And then I was like, that's already a joke. But then Tom corrects him that little Sebastian was a horse, and Jean-Ralphio says, yeah, because he followed his dreams.
It's amazing.
So
it's amazing.
It's just funny stuff. It's just funny stuff. So we have to comment on Nick Offerman's look after he gets his eyebrows burned off. And it's like, this guy gets his eyebrows burned off and his hair looks crazy. I don't know how they did that. Was that a wig? I like, it looks crazy. It's very curly. It looks matted. It looks like animal fur almost. And his mustache looks insane. I know what happened. They shaved it off and put some prosthetic and mustache stuff on. But I was surprised. Also, like, he suffered no burns. Did anyone think to like maybe that's just the Ron Swanson legend, right? That he's such a superhero. Maybe he's impervious to, maybe he's like Colossus from the X-Men, just impervious to burns or whatever. But yeah, it's one of the weirdest. He almost looks. Yeah, I'm trying to think who he looks like. He looks like a cartoon character.
He's a cartoon character for sure.
Yeah, he looks like
it's Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, it's that cross with like a Family Guy character or something. Yeah, there's something about his face or the shape of his face, like afterwards, it's so strange. Other songs played during Lil Sebastian's memorial, besides 5,000 Candles in the Wind, include Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones and A Horse with No Name by America. This got to be the time the Parks and Rec music clearance department answers their phone, having been asleep all season, because we never do music. So they must have been like, well, Rolling Stones song? Yeah. It's like, oh, we can clear that. We all our music budget is used on this song because there's no music in the show.
I would have pitched, I think it was a huge missed opportunity with one of my favorite Yacht Rock songs, Wildfire. It's actually about a horse that dies.
Wildfire.
In a snowstorm. And it's super sad.
Go back in time and shoot it again.
Yeah.
Shoot it again. What are other horse songs? I'm trying to think.
Well, better yet, horse death songs.
Yes, that's true. Oh, Old Town Road, Lil Nas X, Travel Back in Time. Put that in.
right, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll think about that. Send them in if you got them. All right, let's continue with synopsis. At a party afterwards, Andy receives praise for his Lil Sebastian tribute song, 5,000 Candles in the Wind. April sells many Mouse Rat CDs at an inflated price, which spurs Andy to ask her to become the group's manager. Indirectly responsible for nearly killing Ron, Leslie and Ben agree to no more secret displays of affection at work. Anne, who previously dated Chris and had trouble getting over him, offers comfort to Chris for his depression. This makes him feel romantically interested in Anne once again. A conflicted Tom decides to resign and accept a job with Entertainment 720. Meanwhile, Ron is confronted by his evil ex-wife Tammy at the party, but both Ron and Tammy are horrified to learn his other ex-wife, also named Tammy, who he calls Tammy One, also has arrived in town. That's a lot.
Oof.
A lot of you love a big like courtyard party scene. Everyone get your stories done. Yeah. It's like that's how it is. Like, yeah. That's a finale though. I mean, that's a finale. Like I'm having just shot a finale of the new show, season finale is very similar where it's like, they're all in the same place and they're all talking to each other. That's a TV show. That's a TV
show. It's a lot of stuff to wrap up. It's the end of the year.
Yes.
You got to wrap it up.
Yes. You know, just to let people in on this, it's kind of, I think Mike subscribes to this theory and I subscribe to it too a bit, which is, you know, something from Greg Daniels as well, which is just get as many balls up in the air as you can at the end of a finale. Make it as juicy as possible, as many cliffhangers for everybody. Why not? And then hope and pray that over the summer you can figure out what happens next. You don't need to necessarily know, because you'll figure it out. You got a team of smart writers. Hopefully you've thought about the characters enough. So that was kind of the theory here. So for instance, when Donna runs in to alert Ron and Tammy 2 that Tammy 1 has showed up, we didn't know who Tammy 1 was. We didn't have an actor yet. We didn't know what the character was. But it's like, we'll figure it out. That's a funny beat. It's a funny escalation. It's a funny turn. Let's figure out who Tammy 1 is, right? We do that over the summer. And same thing kind of with the Leslie stuff, which we'll talk about in a second, and the Tom stuff. It's like, okay, we know we have Entertainment 720, but we don't know exactly what happens. We'll figure it out. So that's kind of what happens in between seasons. Just a peek behind the curtain. Celebrity death songs. Quick detour into celebrity death songs.
Yes.
I think the biggest one cited in this show, Elton John, Candle in the Wind, right? It says Marilyn Monroe and Princess Di. I didn't realize Marilyn Monroe was part of that.
That's
a remake. That's the original.
No, the best is, it was the original is Marilyn Monroe, right?
Yes.
And then I always thought it was so weird. I mean, and I love Elton. I love him as a friend and his music, he's the man. But I always thought it was so taking the lyrics of that hit and changing them to Princess Diana.
That is weird, isn't it?
Sounds like a bit. It almost sounds like something like a comedy bit.
It's like, why?
You lived your life as if you couldn't go to the Duran Duran concert you wanted to because the crown wouldn't approve it. And you're like, what? It was really bizarre, I have to say.
It's almost like, was he just like, I don't want to write a new one?
There's also that.
Should I call Bernie up? Nah, you know what? Let's just do it. But you know what? Great song. I think more people know the Princess Di version, right? So
yeah,
I'm
a big like fan of songs that have weird, eerie deaths, like The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Anybody know that song?
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's a great, it's an entire ship that goes down. Everybody dies on The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
And
number one hit. And one of my favorites that I actually did as a spoken word performance at the Just for Laughs Festival.
Oh my God.
In Montreal. Yes, I did a...
What year was this?
A spoken word of 90, it was right after Austin Powers, so what? It was, and I did it as Robert Wagner.
Okay.
So that's pretty obscure.
I get that. There you go. There's the comp, and there's the impersonation aspect. Just for Last is fun. I've done Just for Last as well.
It's fun.
I feel like I did a panel there and enjoyed Montreal. I remember we were shooting in Rome or in Italy, and then we flew from Rome to Montreal and did the panel. It was very fun.
It's a good city. Yeah, Shout out to Montreal, everybody.
Shout out to JFL, Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
Do it again sometime. Maybe we'll do this podcast there.
Or as they like to say it, juste pour le rire.
Juste pour le rire. And just a couple more celebrity deaths. AC/DC, Back in Black.
That's about celebrity death?
Bon Scott, it says here.
I never knew that.
I didn't know that. Neutral Milk Hotel and the Airplane Over the Sea, mentioned in a previous episode. It's about Anne Frank's death. And The Long Winters, The Commander Thinks Aloud, Space Shuttle Columbia. I'm getting in the Zoom here. Bon Scott was the original singer of AC/DC. That's wild. I actually didn't know that. You know, you come for the Parks and Rec trivia, you stay for the AC/DC trivia.
That's right. That's right.
All the overlap Venn diagram of early hard rock heavy metal fans and Parks and Rec fans. All right, let's keep marching forward here. Synopsis. Leslie's approached by scouts looking for potential candidates.
Wait, there's more story?
There's more story. It's 26 minutes long. It's almost over.
How can there be more story? We've done nothing but talk about things that happen. It goes on and on.
It moves quickly.
Oh, my God. I mean,
it's a finale.
It is.
It's a finale.
You're right.
You got to pack it all in.
Yeah, you do.
It's not a penultimate episode. It's a finale. Leslie's approached by scouts looking for potential candidates for elected office, which has always been one of her dreams. Impressed by the memorial service and the Harvest Festival Leslie previously organized, they believe she would be a good candidate for upcoming city council seats or possibly even the mayoral position. With the expected increased media attention on her personal life, the scouts ask whether Leslie has any secret scandals in her life. She denies any such scandals exist, thus admitting her secret relationship with Ben. And the scouts promise to contact her about preparing an electoral run. And by the way, there's an additional tag that's not even in the synopsis where we go to Entertainment 720. We'll talk about it in a bit. But Amy's performance when she tells them there's no scandals, very magnetic. You know, you can read it on her face. And then we rack to Ben. She plays a lot of emotions. We had a lot of bits in the writer's room about William and Elizabeth, who are the two people who come. Like, it's a little bit like they step out of another show because they're very serious. It's almost like a weird drama scene near the end of the episode. But these actors, I mean, God bless them. They're doing it, right? They're doing what we told them to do. Their names are Johnny Sneed and Antonio Raftu. But they're very serious.
Yeah, were they supposed to be on the Grey's Anatomy set? Name it.
I mean, you know what show they could have been from?
I do.
Ray Donovan.
They could have been.
But they are very serious. They're like, and it's also like, I like the idea that Pawnee is this small, sleepy, theoretically backwater town, but there's a whole political consultancy firm who's swooping in to see who decides who's going to run for city council. Yeah. It's like, damn, what are they? Who's paying these people?
Yeah.
Like, where's the money in there? William and Elizabeth, are they like living in like a two bedroom or like are they living in a studio apartment? How are they paying their bills? Where's the money in this? Anyway, it is a funny joke later on where I think it's a future episode where he's like, are you guys together? Like, that is one of my favorite jokes about those two characters. But, you know, we didn't know. And just speaking back to the cliffhanger idea, kind of like throw all the balls in the air, story balls in the air, and just figure them out later. We didn't really know what she was going to run for. So like we kind of threw city council and mayor up there, and we knew it would be a campaign for some kind of public office because that seemed like a reasonable next step. But we left a lot of it unspecified. And I think that's another little trick I think that people probably pick up on. But yeah, it focused on how a complicated Leslie and Ben's romance, because that's what we knew would happen. But yeah, this season also was 16 episodes. And the reason was, I see here in the notes, people are asking, why was this season 16 episodes? Was it the writer's strike? The answer was, we were pushed to mid-season. So we did not premiere until mid-season. So instead of a 22-episode order, we only needed to do 16.
I mean, this show was all over the schedule.
It was really moved around. There was a show called Outsourced that got picked up ahead of us, I think, and that aired that season at the beginning. They were really excited about that show. And then we got pushed to mid-season. And then from then on, I think after the first 3 years were really sort of a bumpy ride, I would say.
Network executives and the suits take a lot of shit all the time from creative people. And some of the time it's unearned and some of the times it's earned. But I just want to take a moment for all of us to consider a world where they're like, hey, Parks and Recreation, why don't you guys take a seat? Because we've got Outsourced, okay, coming on. So you guys, why don't you just cool your jets for a while?
Felt like that happened almost every year. It was Outsourced, and it was Whitney, I think, the Whitney Cummings show. And yep. There's a few other ones. I forget what else. But
and every year it was like, hey, Parks and Rec, we love what you guys do, sort of. So why don't you guys just chill? Because we really think we got lightning in a bottle with Whitney.
I mean, no one's foresight is 2020, but it certainly seems in retrospect that they weren't exactly sure what they had in the show. And
I always heard that I don't want to name names, but it was somebody running the network literally was like, I don't think that show's funny. I'm sorry. I don't get it. Does it make me laugh? I don't get it.
And that checks out.
And then, but when that's what you're dealing with, that's how you end up with, you know, short orders, 16, then it's 8, then it's 6, and maybe you're not, maybe you're in the fall, maybe you're not. It's like, they just ran this show around like,
yes,
it got no respect.
And it survived. It survived. Yep. Like a cockroach. Just survived.
Yep.
Let's not forget the tag of this episode, which is batshit insane. Mike Schur, here's a quote from him. He called the episode's final scene, which was filmed in a completely white 15,000 square foot office of Tom's Entertainment Company, maybe the craziest thing that's ever been on a series. I personally remember going to this set and playing basketball with Detlef Schrempf. I have photos where I'm, for some reason, wearing a gray pea coat and posting Detlef Schrempf up. I guess it must have been cold in that warehouse. But I remember playing with him. I remember playing with Lorenzo, one of our PAs, and Aziz and Ben Schwartz.
Wait, can I just say, between you and Lorenzo, they you might you got you're not tall men.
No, I'm about 5'10", and Detlef Schrempf is about 6'10". Lorenzo is not a tall man either. Lorenzo was probably, I would say, under 5 foot. He's under 5'6", yeah. Let's say. So he's. But Lorenzo was beloved. By the way, shout out Lorenzo.
We love Lorenzo.
Everyone loved him, and he was rapidly promoted, and he was kind of one of the liaisons between the brains and all the cast, and so like kind of like the yep. He would interface between the director and the writers and the cast, and you know, always there for everybody. Very reliable, great energy. So shout out to Lorenzo if you're listening, or if anyone knows Lorenzo, say hi. Just really quick, final thoughts on this episode. Just want to run through gifts, parties, and jobs. There's a couple parties, or there's a couple jobs, and there's definitely a party celebrating Lil Sebastian. Huge party in the courtyard where all the stories get wrapped up. There's a new job for April, Mouse Rat Manager, and there's a new job for Tom, Entertainment 720, and there's a new job for Leslie, running for public office. So there's a fair amount. There's a fair amount there. This is a packed season.
I gotta pop in and tell you some big changes that happened from an earlier.
Oh yeah, please,
Two significant changes, and they changed in 1 week. From the table draft to the shooting draft. So one of the big ones, I want to get your take on it, is that Ron finds out and tells Leslie and Ben that he knows that they've been sleeping together at the very end of the episode. And what happens earlier is that the same custodian who came in with Shania Twain's Man, I Feel Like a Woman catches them making out. And that starts the feeling of maybe we're not being careful enough. And so Ron reveals in Act 3, he knows that they've been sleeping together, and they decide to tell Chris tomorrow that they have this thing. And they're like, we're just going to tell him and just see what happens and let him tell us, you know, what our fate is. And they decide to make out one last time, and they stumble into Chris's office, and Chris is making out with Tammy. Do you remember this?
Wow. What? Wait, what?
Do you
wait,
remember
what?
This?
This is a bombshell. This yes. is producer Greg coming in with
gold.
With just haymakers.
Yes.
What?
Yes. It
That's
kind of,
insane.
It flummoxed me the same way it did you.
Was this set up? Like, did we have him like
our rationale?
Because he was thinking about his mortality, yes. And like he just wanted to, like, a fling or something, right?
Yes, and that conversation with Anne about seizing life, and then Tammy comes
life.
In. Well, Tammy comes in, you know, super, hot as she does, and they stumble in, and they see that he's making out with some woman we don't know who it is, and then Chris and Leslie say, "Hey," and then we see it's a pixelated Tammy wearing no top.
Right. Oh, wow.
Of course.
Jeez.
So, if you have Tammy.
Sounds like a Dan Gore pitch, but yeah. Loves pixelation. But that isn't that a little bit stakes negating? Because the stakes are that Chris will catch him, but then if they catch Chris doing that, like, isn't that a little bit stake? Anyway, now I'm talking like a studio exec or another writer in the room being like, well, this is why we shouldn't do that. But we ended up not doing it. I can't believe we read that at the table. I have no recollection of that.
Me neither.
Yeah, in a show called Parks and Recollection, I have zero recollection of that. And we were there. Presumably, you were reading it, and I was there listening, and I helped write it. So that's very crazy. But I'm glad we didn't do that. It seems wrong.
And Tammy, obviously Tammy 1, Megan Mullally.
Yes, Tammy 2.
Yes, yes. Technically Tammy 2. But yes.
The original Tammy is Tammy
1. Yes. And we have a Tammy 0, as we'll learn about soon enough.
Yes, it was also Tammy 0. That's when you know the show's going on a long time, when you get a Tammy 0.
My pitch is that the reason what didn't happen is that Nick Offerman, after the table read, went to Mike Schur and said, listen, Megan Mullally is my wife. She has already made out with Rob Lowe in About Last Night. And I cannot have it again. That's what I think happened.
Again. That's crazy. I was going to say, like, that would have been interesting. Like, you did it already.
I did it.
Years ago. Hollywood is a small town sometimes.
It is a small town. It is.
Keep that in mind.
Okay, one more.
This is good. It's going to be hard to top that.
I know. It is hard to top it, but I had to do it in order of sequence. The idea that Leslie's approach to run for public office did not exist until the very end of the shooting draft being made. It wasn't in the table draft. It really wasn't in a lot of our notes. It was a whole scene or two written at the very end. And as I was reading the script, I think I realized what we all realized, which is that Leslie is actually quite light in the end of this episode. She pretty much has this one moment with Ron and Ben, and then going in and seeing Chris making out with someone else. And so, like you were saying, Alan, I think what we talked about in the room was, let's just set up a whole bunch of stuff. And I think the other thing, if memory serves me right, is that we always wanted to do a storyline about her running for office, but I think we're nervous about doing it so soon into a show that's about politics, not wanting to make it a campaign show. The West Wing had just, I think, at the same time done like a season and a half of a political campaign. And then I think the realization was, we're going to do it. Let's do it. And let's just commit to it right now.
That I remember. I remember just the long discussion of, should we do the campaign season four or not? And by the way, speaking of all the executives and what they're, I think in the back of Mike's mind was probably, well, how many seasons is this show going to go? If we're going to do it, just do it, right? Let's do it. Why are we saving bullets, right? That's kind of the thing that we talked about in the room. So we knew we were going to do it eventually, so it made sense. But I do think that the counter argument to that was, this show was pitched and presented and conceived as a show about public service of non-elected officials, basically bureaucrats. And then we're like, okay, well, are we going to immediately go into that? And, you know, it ended up being fine. You know what? People don't watch it for the job. People watch it for the characters. So, I mean, that's ultimately what happened. And it's like, it's a new situation.
It's a big Greg Berlanti, who's a very proficient, prolific, great showrunner, movie producer, you name it. When on Brothers and Sisters, he would always say, if you have a good story idea, tell it. Tell it now. Don't wait for the next episode.
Don't wait for next season.
Tell it now.
Yeah. Tell, you have it, like, you got the juice, like, use it, man. You got, by the way, it's Easter egg, fun fact, I live in Greg Berlanti's old house.
Oh, there you go.
It's like kind of funny. I was like, oh, man, that's kind of funny. But he's absolutely very prolific. All right, Greg, great trivia, great information about the table read changes. I didn't remember that stuff. Always adding value. Let's go through the oops moments quickly. At 1906, Ron claims he's cried only twice in his life. Once when I was 7 and hit by a school bus. And then again when I heard that little Sebastian had passed. Aww. However, he fails to mention the time he cried in his office with Leslie. In this office with Leslie, after Tammy took control of his life in season 2's Ron and Tammy. I didn't remember that. That's kind of interesting. I believe the joke used to be I was 7 and hit by a Jeep or something. Anyway, I don't know why we changed it to school bus, but they're both funny. Donna mispronounces words from Jerry's Italian poem, but later we'll reveal Donna is an opera singer. So wouldn't she know how to pronounce these beautiful foreign words? In fact, Donna will later sing the flower duet from the opera Lakme later in the series. That's kind of interesting.
Amazing.
Kind of interesting. Episode MVP, most valuable Pawnee, and which character moment in this episode sticks out to you the most and why?
Little Roll Sebastian. Come on. Wow, I'm pouring it out for little Sebastian.
That is great. I would say first star, Lil Sebastian. Second star, Mouse Rat for the song, which is eternal. And then third star, the Fireball. So
yes, that's, agreed.
That's it. Call to action. Listeners, let us know who your MVP is by tweeting at Team Coco Podcast or by using the hashtag Parks and Recollection. Shall we do the town hall?
Yes, the final town hall of our season one. I'm very excited.
We'll do it on the stage of the Lil Sebastian Memorial, where the legendary 5,000 Candles of the Wind was just performed. Take it away, producer Rob Schulte.
Hey, Rob, Alan, Greg Schulte. This is Corey. I'm from New York City. I love Parks and Rec. I've rewatched it over and over again throughout the years. I don't think any television comedy has ever done such a great job of building a world with all these different characters, you know, so far in the background, but so funny and so memorable. And I mean, I guess there are a few that come close, maybe Freaks and Geeks, maybe Community, but I was wondering if you guys had any ideas of another show that really created this immersive world. Thanks for what you're doing. I love it.
Well, that's a great, thank you. I mean, what do you, The Simpsons?
The Simpsons is probably number one, and there's a couple things about The Simpsons. That's the biggest world ever created, partly because there are, what, 30 seasons or something?
Right.
I mean, 700 episodes or whatever it is. Shout out to the people over there. Matt Selman, one of my friends, helps run that show, and a bunch of the writers are buddies. But they've done incredible work for so long. And in a way, we would talk about Springfield a lot in the writer's room of Parks as we continue to build our world out. I was actually going to mention Community, too, because their run obviously wasn't as long as The Simpsons. But they shot right next to us, which is kind of cool. They were our NBC neighbors. I keep thinking of animated shows because Futurama also was almost like obviously a future version of The Simpsons, or Rick and Morty is really a world building thing. Live action, I will say this, that's credit. Thank you for Corey for pointing it out, because Parks did a really specific job of doing that. Like not many shows build out the town like that. I was thinking like Seinfeld does a little bit of it, you know, they ran a long time and you start to get to know the diner and the Babu and all those other characters, the dentist, but they don't come back in the same way that they do in Parks and Rec. You know, it's like you see Pert Hapley like 50 times, you know, you just see him a lot of times, and there's not a lot of sitcoms that do that. So a lot of them are the animated ones I found. I don't know. Family Guy is another one, right? In South Park, they all kind of build worlds, but a lot of those are animated, you know.
Is 30 Rock maybe?
30 Rock's good. Yeah, 30 Rock's good. Again, it feels like, you know what's interesting is 30 Rock's about New York City in some way. So it's like they have a zany world, but it's not a fake made up world. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
Dr. Spaceman, I mean, yeah, that's a good one. I feel like and people do come back, right? It's like,
but it's not like Parks, it isn't. It's not like Parks.
Yeah, it's just a different thing where I think because here's actually an idea. That actually answers the question. It's interesting because it's a fictional town, right? Like 30 Rock is New York. It's a zany version of New York, but Parks and Rec, it's like Pawnee's made up. So, you know, we could take a lot of liberty in sort of building all these side characters. But no, it's a good point. I think that's one of the strengths of the show for sure. And it's something that you know, I don't think was intended necessarily from the beginning. It was something that built organically. And sometimes that's the best way to write a show.
I think dramas have a greater success at doing it more. Also just because of the breadth of storytelling, that it's sometimes less localized on just your comedy characters and how they interact and the comedic, you know, situations you can put them in. And I immediately thought of The Wire, which was the inspiration one of the inspirations for the show. But one of the joys of watching any of these shows like Community or Parks or The Wire or whatever is watching the show and seeing these people, even if they pop up in the background and it connects two pieces and you just feel like you're being taken care of by the people who make it, that they're like, we have an idea, we have a world, and we're bringing you into it.
That's great. And The Wire is a great call because we did talk about that show incessantly in the writer's room. You know, Mike was obsessed with it and a lot of the writers were obsessed with it. We actually had a chart of this is some of the time killing the writer's room. This is why we ended up staying so late and the guy walked in playing Shania Twain. We had a chart of all of these other shows and who the writers were of the characters on that show. So for The Wire, like, this guy's Presbo, this guy's, you know, Stringer Bell, this guy's
wow.
Whoever, like it was really, and then we did that for Game of Thrones. We did that for Breaking Bad. We did that for Mad Men.
Jesus,
I was Sterling. Yeah, I was Sterling. I think I was. I was.
But did you do it
John
for
Slattery's character,
Ray Donovan?
We did not do it for Ray Donovan. Maybe, you know what? When we do the reboot of Parks and Rec, we'll have to do it for Ray. Who gets to be Ray?
Oh, that's a real.
I don't know any other characters on the show, but yeah.
Guys, I have the chart. It's called Who Are You? It took 7 seasons to make, and I'll let you know that every person has a Wire person, a Game of Thrones a character, a Breaking Bad character, and then in the biopic, who would star as them. So we'll tease that exists, and we'll tell people about it coming up.
Cliffhanger for next season. I mean, what a great season, guys. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll be back soon with the next season. I'm taking that as a legally binding pickup from Team Coco and Stitcher. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, all the people who wrote in and sent in town halls and town howls. Keep them coming, and hopefully we'll get to do some more episodes and more seasons. Subscribe where you get your podcast. 5-star review on Apple. Thank you to Schulte and Greg, of course, everyone involved in the show, and goodbye from Pawnee.
For now, we'll see you next season.
Cliffhanger.
Parks and Recollection is produced by Greg Levine and me, Rob Schulte. Our coordinating producer is Lisa Berm. The podcast is executive produced by Alan Yang for Alan Yang Productions, Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Jeff Ross, Adam Sachs, and Joanna Solitaroff at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson at Stitcher. Gina Batista, Paula Davis, and Britt Kahn are our talent bookers. The theme song is by Mouse Rat, a.k.a. Mark Rivers, with additional tracks composed by John Danick. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Parks and Recollection.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.